As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The race is on. One of the big stories of the 2019 Formula One season was McLaren's revival, taking a comfortable fourth in the Constructors' Championship to bring an end to some tough seasons. The aim was to build on that this year, only for the season not to get going as planned. I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to delve into the impact this is having on McLaren and its ambitions to re-establish itself as a top team are Mark Hughes and Scott Mitchell. So Mark, are you happy with the amount you're allowed to spend on this podcast, or are you going to threaten to flounce off to IndyCar or Le Mans?
Hey, look, you know, if you try and restrict how much energy I can provide to your podcast, I might just go and do another podcast about rally choppers or Can-Am or glam rock or something. You can't restrict me in that way, Ed.
I can't believe you don't already do a podcast about rally choppers, but of course we've got to be careful about not misinterpreting your threats about how you're going to deploy your DNA.
Yes. I mean, this is obviously you're referring to Ferrari talking about if the budget cap's brought down too low, rather than lose valuable people and skills build up over many years within the company, it would reluctantly diversify into other championships, high profile championships, possibly Le Mans, possibly IndyCar. So, do we take that threat seriously? I think it has to be acknowledged. It's a possible way out of a bind that Ferrari might find itself in. But let's see if it comes to that.
Yeah, it's a different take on something we've heard a few times before. It's not a quit threat, but a diversification threat. But how about you, Scott? Are you threatening to reluctantly diversify, or are you all right?
I was going to say I might make my own podcast, never publish it, and then display it in a museum. That might be my strategy.
Very good, like the Ferrari 637. Yeah, very good.
I would just add to what Mark was saying. I think it's a non-quit threat, although it sounds slightly odd to say. A non-quit threat is more dangerous than a quit threat from Ferrari for me. Firstly, because a real quit threat from Ferrari is not a real one, is it? But this is something that they might actually do. I would assume that Le Mans is a little bit more likely than going off and doing an IndyCar engine program or something like that. But I think don't dismiss it entirely. I certainly roll my eyes less at the prospect of Ferrari redeploying money and staff elsewhere than I do them walking away from F1, which is absolutely fundamental to their business.
yeah, Formula One, it's often said Formula One needs Ferrari, and it does, but also Formula One and Grand Prix racing has been very, very good to Ferrari over the years as well. There's a reason that it's been permanently around, basically, certainly in the World Championship era and obviously in various forms before that. It's good to see, though, that the spirit of unity and collaboration and one objective is still there for all the Formula One teams in these difficult times, isn't it? I for one, am staggered that the politicking is now going on.
Yeah, well, we're going to be... It's quite fitting that we've started this McLaren podcast with a few jokes about Ferrari, given that those are the two teams that seem to be positioned as at loggerheads over the very soul and fabric of Formula One.
That there is a good point at the heart of this in that, again, we are talking about real people and real jobs here. So although I think we all agree that you want to see a Formula One that's a little bit more equitable and sustainable and balanced, etc., you've got to be very, very careful when regulation might force jobs to be lost that aren't otherwise lost, which of course is why Ferrari is talking about potentially redeploying people.
Yeah, exactly. And I think if you try and go from the size that the top teams have become over the last 20 years down to how they were 20 years ago, it's too much of a shock. It's too much of a shock to the system. And trying to have a glide path down in the current economic crisis is also very difficult as well. So you've got those conflicting pulls. So it's trying to navigate a safe way through that the F1's trying to get its head around at the moment.
And also worth saying that times of crisis aren't necessarily the best time to try and do these big changes, because sort of people are talking about this as an opportunity to reset F1, etc. But doing that sort of thing under duress, that is not the way to do it, because you'll never get a good outcome. That the focus has to be on the short term at this stage. But this is going to run and run, isn't it, Scott, with just teams debating this and argue this? I guess because the timeline on it is slightly less urgent and they can spend a bit of time debating it, then that does create a fertile environment for some politics.
Yeah, they did a good job of working through a few short-term things, didn't they, with delaying the rules and bringing forward and extending the shutdown and not allowing teams to develop for the new rules until next year. So the short-term stuff was really good. And there was genuinely, I know we were sort of mocking it a little bit, but there was this sort of genuine sense of unity when it came to the short-term stuff, because it was urgent. But as you say, as soon as that little bit of slack creeps in, all of a sudden, a leopard can't change its spots, can it?
Well, should we move on to the main event and talk about McLaren? Mark, Andreas Seidel has talked about the current Formula One situation and how it might cause a few delays in what he called its recovery program. Given the momentum the team had, the upward trajectory, how big a blow do you think this hiatus is to a team that's really got a lot of work to do and is making good progress, but has got lofty ambitions to, in the long term, to get back up there?
Yeah, I mean, it made a great progress last year from a disastrous 2018. And took a clear fourth best of the rest after the big three teams in the championship. And that's about where its performance was as well. The position and the performance tallied quite strongly. But there was still over a second a lap off the pace, off the ultimate Mercedes pace, let's say. So, yeah, it's still a long way to go, because that's where they aspire to be. They aspire to be back up at the front. And that's quite a big journey they've still got to make. It's still a big part of that journey they've still got to make. I think in one sense, the delay just freezes everyone at the point that they were at. But if we're talking of trimming staff and programs to meet a really slashed budget cap, yeah, that means the bigger teams carry less advantage over McLaren, but it also means McLaren's own programs of improvement are slowed. So they're busy building a new wind tunnel, for example, which is a hugely costly endeavor. And if that has to be divided out into more than 1 year to get under the budget cap, that would have an impact on the team's competitiveness and how quickly it could make that progress to the front. Seidel was saying in that conference he did last week that the big three teams are just better at everything, because I was asking, I said, look, you've all got the same restriction on wind tunnel hours and CFD capacity. What is it that they're doing better? And he said, basically, they're doing everything better. He said, it's not just about how much tunnel and CFD time you have. It's about how good your groups of people are at analyzing the data that those tools throw out, and how many people that you've got to be able to throw at those problems. And it's just depth and layers and layers and layers of expertise that's making the difference. So long term, I think a tight budget cap would be in McLaren's favor, but it could delay the journey a little.
I would just add that, as well as the short term impact of pausing what's going on at the moment, so the physical work, the infrastructure work at the factory that they're having to just wait to undertake. There's also the fact that going into this season with a reduced number of races, and then carrying over this car into 2021. First of all, the fact that the new rules have been delayed from 2021 to 2022 is a fundamental delay. That the new rules were meant to be the catalyst with which McLaren takes an even bigger step back to the front. So they'd now have to wait at least 1 year to be able to do that. But in the short term, there are other consequences as well. One of the things that I find interesting is what the worst case scenario for F1 this year, and it is a case that F1 is planning for because it has to consider it, is that there aren't any races, or that it's a really, really short season. So what happens if there are no or hardly any races this year? How does McLaren judge the quality of the MCL35, which is the brainchild of new technical director James Key? You want to make sure that the progress in 2019 wasn't just a fluke, that the aerodynamic processes have been properly refined, and that they've been able to not only improve on the weaknesses of the 2019 car, but also that the ideas that James wants to deploy on the car are working as well. Because when you get into, if you're carrying that over into 2021 as well, obviously that's all baked into the car. But then when you go into 2022, or whenever these new technical rules come in, how can you be completely confident that you're going to absolutely nail those rules if you don't have a full season of racing with this car to make sure that all your processes are in place and your aerodynamic ideas are sound?
And not only that, but as well as evaluating where you are, the car and racing it and developing it is also the real world dynamic experiment, isn't it? It's a test bed for working on ideas and your theories of how to do things and to deepen your understanding of the underlying science. I mean, this is what you talked about, Mark. The best teams do everything better. And that's down to depth of understanding and experience and volume of data and just the fact that they've been through this process over the years and they've learned the subtleties and the tricks. And particularly when it comes to some of the more complicated elements of the way a Grand Prix car performs. So if you've got a truncated season, a condensed season as we will have this year, not only do you have less chance to kind of understand where you're at, but also less time to play with the car and learn and develop it. Of course, they'll be carrying it over into next season, so there's still time there. But every way you slice it, there is a loss of time. Fundamentally, it's unavoidable. You can't fight that, can you?
No, that's true. And when you have been on a program like the top three teams of just constant evolution of something that fundamentally works, you're going to have a much deeper understanding of the nuances of any changes that are made than a team which is trying to make big steps to catch up to that level. It's just inevitable. So, and then picking up on the point that Scott made, one of the things about the new regulations whenever they come in is that they've been conceived to make them much less say budget sensitive in terms of aerodynamics. So a 20 million budget advantage currently buys you half a second or a 7/10 of a second, the idea is that it might only buy you a 10th of a second. So there's less differentiation aerodynamically possible between the cars in the new regulations and the old ones. And that that will always be the benefit of those teams that were relatively to those teams that were behind the top three. And you've got to put McLaren in that bunch.
Scott, we should try and discern roughly where we think McLaren are. Obviously, if we think to the before times when the world was functioning, we can dimly remember there was pre-season testing. So we have seen the 2020 cars running. If you think back, you might just be able to remember it. So it's worth kind of a refresher in where we think McLaren may be, because pre-season testing was pretty decent for them, but still inconclusive.
Yeah, I think it was more productive than it was headline grabbing. McLaren were really happy with the mileage that they logged in the first week. They were Carlos Sainz was pretty happy with what the sort of base car was doing in week one, and he said that was then going to be developed quite significantly for test two and then the early races, and then in test two they seemed quite happy with the correlation. So it's difficult to know exactly. I think the potential of the pink Mercedes, the Racing Point, was sort of threw a bit of a curveball into the midfield mix, didn't it? I think if you look at the conventional progression from the other teams within this stable set of regulations, so you're looking at let's say AlphaTauri and Renault. I think McLaren looked pretty decent, but I wouldn't necessarily have bet my flat that McLaren was going to go to Australia and be best of the rest. But that is also partly because I don't own my flat, so it's not really mine to bet with.
I think that's the art of betting, isn't it? Bet with someone else's money and resources. That's a good way of doing it. But it's an interesting comparison, isn't it, Mark, looking at where McLaren is compared to, say, a Racing Point. Two very, very different approaches strategically. Racing Point has, by its own admission, copied the Mercedes, but McLaren is trying to go its own way, because that's the aim is that will produce a longer-term potential yield. So, again, this is kind of that battle between those two is at the crux of it's the embodiment of a debate about the future of F1, isn't it? Whether you're a standalone operation or you're piggybacking on the work of others.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be a very contentious issue. And I think if the season had started in Melbourne, we probably have seen that develop into some sort of protest. So that debate has been delayed for a while, but I think it will still absolutely be a point of contention when we do get racing again. The more competitive the Racing Point is, the bigger a problem it's going to be for politically, and the more of a hot potato it's going to be. And McLaren and Renault will be the two that are probably going to be most vociferous in that. And what actually constitutes a team's own car, and what's just a direct copy of a rival.
And this all ties in with what we're talking about the rules being delayed and the opportunity for McLaren to take that next step. Because I asked Seidel at testing what he thinks of the sort of model of that Racing Point idea, and whether he thinks that's something that F1 will sort of evolve into longer term, or if you can still stand alone. And he made the point of this is what the new technical rules are meant to be about, that you will be rewarded for standing on your own. He wants to be an innovator again. He wants McLaren to be an innovator again, not a fast follower, as Racing Point have sort of classed themselves as. And the longer we're waiting, that is an inherent part of that McLaren recovery program. And yeah, they're basically treading water until they can actually get that opportunity to put, their plan into action.
It will be interesting when we do finally get racing to see what happens, because there's been plenty of talk of potential protest. Renault has been suggested as the team that might do it against the Racing Point. And it's not necessarily even in the hope of getting the car rendered illegal, but it's almost about creating a debate and drawing a line in the sand about exactly where being a constructor and being a not constructor, where that line actually falls. McLaren are frustrated about this. Seidel talked about this in testing, in fact, when he said you know, what, where is that line about the transfer of data between teams? Because actually, if you look at the wording of the regulations about that on, say, something like aero, like you have to do your own aero, basically. That's one of the things you have to do to qualify as a constructor and therefore to be able to compete and to earn the money. But it's not ultra precise exactly what the definition is. I think everybody thinks they know what it means, but it's not necessarily quite as emphatically in the rules as wanted to be. So if there is some kind of proper protest, it will be about the wider picture. And you can understand it, really, because there's this fundamental tension, because I think you can go so far as a secondary team piggybacking off another. But if you want to actually win consistently and win championships in Formula One, you probably do need to be a leader still.
Yeah, you've got to be going your own way. It's the only way you're going to get an advantage. Otherwise, you're forever going to be behind whoever it is that you're copying. I think McLaren's aspirations to return to the front, where, you know, McLaren was always associated with being, you know, ever since the Ron Dennis revitalized it in the 80s. It's been considered one of the absolute top teams until very recently, really. That, you know, the ambition to get back there means that there's no way McLaren would be thinking of doing anything other than plowing its own furrow and doing it completely from its own initiative and its own expertise. So the argument strikes at the very heart of what McLaren is trying to do. So I can see why they're so sensitive to it.
It's an interesting situation McLaren finds itself in, because it slid down from being a front runner into being basically a back marker, as it was a couple of years ago. Arguably, of its own volition, should we say, there wasn't some massive fundamental outside force that led. If you look at a team like, say, Enstone, there were big reasons why that team slip back from winning races and even championships, as it was before that, into really struggling, and then it's sort of trying to rebuild again. But McLaren fell behind before our eyes, didn't it? And although there were some reasons for it, and you can go back to the obviously the 100 million fine was a significant point, because that did have an impact. It's an interesting experiment in kind of a team dropping back and then trying to catch up for those. I mean, it's basically a decade it spent falling behind the big teams, isn't it, Mark?
Yeah, and I think in the wake of the 100 million fine, it became a team that was riven by internal management friction and arguments, and those struggles went on over several years. And it was during those years that the team just progressively fell further and further behind. And I think the switch to Honda Power, which was no two ways about it, it was a very uncompetitive engine during the time that McLaren had it. It allowed McLaren to kid itself that its problems were just the engine, and actually it was continuing to fall behind. And it was a process that we'd seen beginning even before then. And it just became absolutely clear 2 years ago. And that brought everyone there up short. And since then, there have been some pretty deep structural changes made, and this we're seeing it sort of come out of that absolute dip that it had got itself into, and this is scrabbling back out. But it's several years in the making, that, and so it'll be several years to get back out of it.
We are actually seeing that there's at least some credibility underlying McLaren's aspirations now, whereas if you go back to when they were really struggling, it seemed almost impossible that on the trajectory they were on, they could get themselves sorted out. But with the changes they've made, obviously they've got a very good team principal in Andreas Seidel, who sets a very good direction. They've got good personnel in the key positions. So suddenly this idea of McLaren getting back to the front on a long enough timeline doesn't seem so ridiculous with the way they're doing things, does it?
No, it all just seems rooted in logic. And you mentioned Seidel. I think he's the strongest asset that McLaren's got at the moment, because he seems pragmatic where he needs to be. He seems to be quite a good motivator, a good leader of people. And I also think he's been very, very important in McLaren moving on from its Alonso dependency. I think you two are better placed than I am to comment, really. But my experience in 2018 was I just got the impression of that McLaren had slipped into this team that existed almost entirely to serve Alonso and to keep him happy. And I think it was a bit of a distraction. It was often on the Alonso show, and there's no doubt that Fernando is obviously a phenomenal driver, and I'm sure that a lot of the stuff he identified in 2018 played a big part in McLaren finally getting it right. But I think Seidel and the leadership change underneath Zak Brown that has come over the last couple of years has been important, because it has just shifted things away from how do we maneuver things in places. We've got to keep Fernando happy. Fernando wants to do Indy. We need to do Indy as well. And now there just seems to be really clear separation of responsibilities and a much clearer list of priorities in terms of getting the F1 operation up to the standard it needs to be.
If you look at the way that Seidel has approached it, I like the long-term strategic thinking, things like the wind tunnel, which is not an immediate return thing. You know, we often see with teams where they suffer is they want to be brilliant tomorrow. And in trying to be brilliant tomorrow on an unrealistic timeline, all you're doing is just locking yourself into this endless sequence of mediocrity. Whereas actually being able to have the confidence to say, right, we're going to do something that we're not going to feel any benefit for several years at least, I think reflects very, very well, not just on the potential of that long-term planning, but also Seidel himself and the security he's got in what he's doing, in that he's not panicking about his own position, etc. He's thinking, right, this is the way I think it needs to be done. It's not necessarily going to pay me back instantly. And sometimes others will be a little bit more politically minded and worried about trying to look good tomorrow because they don't know they'll still be in a job in a few years. And I think that's an important characteristic, isn't it, Mark?
Yeah, it is. And I mean, when you're talking about a team that has a very clear objective of returning to where it was, which is at the absolute front, you can, and everybody's backing you up, the board is backing you up, the finance people are behind you, then, you know, it makes everyone so much more confident in the program, because it feels like it's not panicked, and it feels like there's a long-term plan about this and everyone's buying into the plan. And you might have setbacks along the way and, you know, hiccups, but the long-term goal remains clear, and you remain on that trajectory. And the longer you can stay on that trajectory, and the more confidence you're inspiring with the people in the organization, the more attractive that organization becomes to talent outside of it as well. And so you can start bringing in talent at all the different levels throughout the layers of the team, and it almost generates its own energy. But that's a very difficult thing to engender, and stability is a crucial part of it.
Yeah, and basically what you're almost talking about, well, what you are talking about there is momentum, isn't it? It's a kind of intangible thing, but it gives you benefits in all sorts of areas, whether it's recruitment, overall performance, et cetera, et cetera. It just, there's so many things you have to get right as a Grand Prix team that you do need to kind of get a snowball built up to have a chance of building to the level you want to get it to. Well, let's have a look at another one of the significant long-term moves, Mark. We know McLaren's switching to Mercedes next year. The 2020 cars are being carried over, so there are restrictions in place governing how much things can be changed, and there are some limitations in what McLaren will be allowed to do, and there'll be a certain amount of oversight because they're the only team changing engines. Originally, this was nicely lined up for the new rules, but now it's coming in to a situation where not only are the rules not changing, but they've got to install it in the current car. So how is that process going to work, and do you think it's going to be a significant limitation for them?
I think there'll be a small amount of compromise in it, because it's technically it's a different layout of engine to the Renault. The Mercedes is a different layout of engine to the Renault. The Renault's got a combined turbine and compressor hanging out the back of it, whereas the Mercedes got a split turbine and compressor with one at the front of the engine and the other at the back. And that's got implications on the packaging of the whole car. So it won't be a perfect integration, but with enough time, it should be possible to minimize the impact. It's not. I don't think it'll be like when they transferred from Honda, which had a Merc-like layout, to Renault, which was so 11th hour, it caused all sorts of problems, not just problems that were sort of stitched into the car itself, but also reliability problems as a result of the hurried changeover because the decision was made so late. So I don't think it's going to be like that. There's been plenty of time, will be plenty of time when the shutdown ever finishes, to make the transition, but it won't be perfect. It won't be as good as if you designed the car around it in the first place.
And Seidel said, didn't he, last week that he was asked, you know, can you make sure with the changes you're allowed to make, can you make sure that the new engine is incorporated in the most efficient way? And he said, no, it can't be in the most efficient way because we're having to adapt a car designed around something else. So that, as you say, there are compromises. There's a sort of a pro and a con to the Merc switch that I see. The con side is, Mark was talking earlier about all of those little things that the top teams are so good at, and they just get better and better and better over time at them. And since departing from Mercedes engines after the 2014 season, McLaren has been quite regularly changing a massive part of its car. It's gone. Apart from Ferrari, it will now have. It's now sampled the other three engines in this engine era. And as Mark was just explaining about the architecture of the engines, everything's different. So whereas all of these top teams, the works teams that have been working on this really intricate the architecture and how to implement that and have chassis and engine working in perfect harmony for years and years now, McLaren's changing between the two, and it is always about, okay, this isn't going to be a massive setback, we're still going to sort of get a decent job out of it, but it's not maximized, and this is Formula One, so absolutely everything needs to be maximized. So that's a con for me. I guess the pro is unlike how it would have been if the technical rules stayed the same, they're not introducing the engine and learning about the engine in the first year of the new rule cycle. So what they will have the opportunity to do is have first-hand experience with that engine next year, how it works, how it fits, what the architecture's like, how it relates to parts of the car, with a free season, effectively, because in 2021 they'll be able to get that experience and then incorporate that when the new technical rules come in.
McLaren have talked about that while finishing fourth in the Constructors' Championship, it is an objective. It's actually secondary to closing to the front on performance. And it can seem counterintuitive to suggest they might be happy with finishing, for the sake of argument, in sixth place, but we're closer to the pace. So what do you think they mean by that?
Well, the dream scenario is that they're best of the rest again, because they know that bridging the gap to the big three is not going to happen. So realistically, the best case scenario is fourth in the Constructors' Championship and the pace percentage deficit to the leaders is reduced. That's the ultimate sign of not only progress, but also the fact that you're still doing a better job than the opposition. We're going back to testing now, but I asked Seidel about the... because the midfield battle is tighter than ever. You've got Racing Point. Racing Point are doing what they're doing, and Renault is a works team. So with sort of minimal room for improvement within the regulations, realistically, there's a chance that McLaren could get jumped again, but the whole point is to keep chipping away at the leaders. So what I asked Seidel was, if you did slip back in the Constructors' Championship because one of the others overhauled you, but you cut that gap to the front three or to the fastest team, would you take that? And he said, yeah, absolutely, because from their point of view, and you can take this as them sort of not being entirely genuine, but their point of view is that everything they're doing at the moment is, it's about putting bricks down and putting that foundation in place and getting to the point where you can then make a much bigger step in the medium term. And if they can get closer in terms of pace, it proves that their process is right. It proves that their car's getting better. And while falling behind a Racing Point or a Renault this year would say that they're not doing as good a job as their opposition, you can still counter that by saying, well, Racing Point are in a bit of a one-off situation because they've copied a car, and they won't be able to do that with the new rules because there won't be another car to copy in advance. And from a Renault point of view, Renault massively underachieved last year as a works team. So is McLaren really slipping back if it falls behind a team that's got exceptional circumstances a year ago? I still think there's an argument there that the trajectory is actually where Seidel and co would like it to be, even if they're not necessarily fourth in the championship.
I'd argue that finishing behind Racing Point is much less of a concern than Renault, because Renault is trying to do the same thing as McLaren is. But Mark, when we're talking about this, it is an unusual situation in Formula One these days, because yeah, they've always been the haves and have-nots. They've always been the group of leading teams. But particularly since those 17 regs came in, that chasm between the big three teams and the rest has been very, very much kind of set in stone, hasn't it? So this thing of kind of bridging across, to use a cycling term, to the lead group is a much bigger challenge than it used to be, which I guess is why McLaren are talking about the deficit, the pace deficit being absolutely critical. And, you know, if you're finishing sixth and you're 0.1% closer on average pace, that's not worth a great deal. But if you're finishing lower and you've halved the gap, for example, and the gaps are from the top three to McLaren, it's about 1% in terms of the chasm. So gaining, say, half of that is a big benefit, should we say. So it's all about the way this manifests itself, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's about the distinction between the short term and the long term. So, you know, the short term, the difference a few million quid is going to make to them finishing fourth or fifth or fourth or sixth isn't that crucial. But if they have finished fourth but were 1.2% away from the front rather than 1%, that's not good. That's going the wrong way. It's interesting you say that the chasm appeared, increased in 2017 with the new regulations, and it's clear now that the wider cars, they pushed the limits, they pushed the wind tunnels and the other tools to much closer to the limits than they were with the narrow cars, and you started to get much more complex problems to solve, aerodynamic problems to solve, and which the big teams had the resource to do, and the smaller ones didn't. And it's one of the limitations that McLaren has found by not having its own wind tunnel, and it uses the Toyota one, which is a great tunnel for its time in the early 2000s, and Ferrari used it for a long time as well. But it's clear that things have moved on, and it's one of the key limitations they have at the moment.
It's funny, isn't it, when you look back at those 17 regulations, they were a spectacular misstep, weren't they? I mean, it was known at the time, but the thing that I find most perverse about that is they set an objective with those, which was for the cars to be, it was 4 to 5 seconds quicker than they'd been in 2015, wasn't it? That was the objective. And if you look at the pole times over 2017, I think on average it was 4.5 seconds difference. So they hit their target perfectly. They set an objective, hit it perfectly, but it was the wrong objective, and they just became obsessed with downforce and more speed is the panacea, didn't they, Scott?
Yeah, I just think they got so obsessed with that. It was almost like there was the brains behind it then sort of got a few races into 2017 and were like, well, hang on a second, why are these cars that are really far through the corners, have much shorter braking zones and are bigger, why are they not racing as well? And it was like nobody in that little bubble had actually considered it, or they had, but they thought that the pure spectacle of what you see over one lap in qualifying, it made the big difference. But I think you can argue all you like about the validity of those regulations. One thing that didn't help is the fact that it doesn't matter how quick these cars are over one lap, because the difference in pace between the modern Formula One cars in qualifying compared to the race, when everyone's just in conservation mode, basically, it's enormous. So what, even if you were thinking, okay, regardless of how bad the racing will be with these new cars, it's going to be worth it because the spectacle is going to be amazing. If that spectacle is confined to a few laps on Saturday afternoon, I can't see how that's worth the trade.
Yeah, it's one of the eternal frustrations for me is how few quick laps you see on a Grand Prix weekend from people. You know, drivers are only doing a very small number of laps within 1-2% of the ultimate pace of their car, which is a real shame. A problem to be solved. But coming back to McLaren, let's have a little bit of a look at the driver lineup, because I think that Carlos Sainz Lando Norris pairing is a very interesting one. I mean, Mark, it strikes me as one to really watch when the season begins, because you've got Sainz, who's operating at a very high level. He took another step last season, was at another level. And Lando Norris had a very, very strong rookie season. In fact, I'd argue his points tally relative to Sainz, given the bad luck that Norris had. They both had some misfortune, but Norris was probably the most unfortunate driver on the grid. I think that exaggerated the gap. How do you see that battle playing out when racing does get going?
I think it's very interesting. And I think it's poised very delicately at the moment, and we're going to find out the reality, because the general perception, I think, is that Sainz is merely a very good driver, not a superstar, and that Lando, as a potential superstar, will ultimately prevail. And if he doesn't, then he wasn't a potential superstar. That's a sort of general perception. But what if Sainz is the superstar? You can make a very sound case for that. I believe that Sainz sets the bar extremely high, and Lando needs to be able to reach it consistently, not just occasionally. It's fine doing it occasionally. It's even expected when in your rookie year, but not really thereafter if you're to maintain your credentials as a potential superstar. So very, very interesting. Lando's got an extremely tough job on his hands, and I think if he matches Sainz, give or take a couple of positions, whatever, just in general performance, if you can't say clearly between them who's had the stronger season, then I think that's probably about as much as Lando could realistically hope for. But he may be thinking that he has to absolutely wipe the floor with Sainz to keep that momentum going, but I don't think that's going to be possible.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating dynamic between the two of them, because they've got this great relationship off track, but they were getting closer and closer on track last year. And to be fair, from early on, Lando proved that that he had at least the pace to put himself in the same vicinity as Sainz on track. It's quite curious, because in terms of what this year means for their respective careers, they've both got a lot on the line, because 2019 was, I felt like 2019 was a real breakthrough season for Sainz, after sort of bouncing around the midfield a little bit and sort of being good, but having a few doubts remaining. I think he really, really established himself as a classy operator in the midfield. So this is really important for him to follow that up, whether we go racing in July, August, September, or not until next year. He needs to follow that up with another really good season to prove that this is the driver he has become, rather than it being other circumstances that brought that out of him. And obviously Norris, yeah, it's the difficult second album, isn't it, from an F1 driver point of view. So he has to prove that all of the hype around him is it isn't just misplaced, and how that impacts their dynamic. With McLaren's going to have more on the line, they're going to want to establish themselves as being worthy of being part of this new era for McLaren. If they do enact their recovery program properly, their very careers in Formula One might be at stake. So how all of that comes together, it creates quite an interesting melting pot.
There was also an interesting trajectory between the two last year, because Norris, you'd expect for a rookie, maybe to start a bit shakier and then kind of build up as the season went on. But actually, we saw a certain amount of reversal of that, with Sainz really asserting himself in the second half of the season, which was when the car was sort of getting better and a little bit more predictable than under. And that's probably the one area of Sainz you'd look at and say, compared to Norris, I think Norris is quite happy with a car you have to hustle the hell out of. he's got quite a wide operating window in that regard. Sainz, a few times when there's a certain level of instability, has struggled a tiny bit. So it partly depends on the car. But Sainz is such a good, well-rounded operator, brilliant executor of races. And he has got that touch of magic in races, which he's always had at times, where he pulls out of the bag really phenomenal results with just perfect race drives. I think the other thing to remember, and this is very positive for McLaren, is driver matchups within teams when you're comparing teammates, it's not a zero-sum game. It's not like one wins everything and whoever's behind loses. What you can have is two drivers who perform at a very high level together, and yeah, one will do slightly better than the other, but we could end up with Sainz and Norris being a very, very strong pairing. And in fact, if you look at that matchup against, say, Racing Point, where you've got Sergio Perez, you know, king of the midfield, really great midfield operator, driver I've got a lot of time for. But then you've got Lance Stroll, a driver with underlying ability, but he struggles to string it together. That could make a massive difference in that battle for best of the rest in the championship. And it shows why drivers are so important in Formula One, because if you look at Renault, McLaren and Racing Point, imagine all three of those cars had exactly the same performance level, then Racing Point isn't going to win that battle for fourth in the championship unless Stroll suddenly managed to click and get everything together. So it's always good for a team, isn't it, Mark, to have two drivers like this, particularly when you've got a little bit of a dynamic of the up-and-comer with the... I hesitate to call Sainz an old hand because he's far from that, but he is an experienced Formula One driver.
Yeah, it's true, and it's also... brings the most out of both drivers as well, to have that level of internal competition. They can't do that thing that you sometimes see when a driver is clearly quicker than his teammate. I'm sure it's a subconscious thing. They don't pull the really devastating laps out of themselves. They just seem to have a different comfort zone. And so I think, yeah, you're going to see those two do that. You're going to see Ricciardo and Ocon probably do that. So, yeah, it is important to have a good matchup, but not a destructive one. And I think that's where the McLaren lineup is so good, because it looks as though it's competitive, but not destructively competitive. And I'd be interested to see how the Ricciardo Ocon one develops in that regard, because I think there's potential there for that not to be a constructive one.
Renault is going to be a very interesting place to watch, particularly, you know, with you've got Esteban Ocon coming in, who's had some problems with Perez before at Racing Point, and you know, we know how good Ocon is, we know how good Ricciardo is, so you've got two drivers there who are very, shall we say, upwardly mobile, which is the same with the McLaren guys, but does seem to be a slightly different dynamic. But it's great. I always think teams benefit from having, it sounds stupid, but strong all-round driver lineups make a huge difference to a team, because no matter what the potential of the car, it has to all channel through the driver. They're the biggest single variable. People suggest that drivers don't matter so much in Formula One, and while the car designs the performance potential, the driver is the biggest single individual component in dictating how much that potential is delivered, which is why it still matters. Well, hopefully we've given a bit of an overview of where McLaren's at. I think it's going to be one of the interesting stories of the season to see how that team progresses. And obviously, I think anyone, even if they're not specifically a McLaren fan, will want to see a team of that heritage and that famous name fighting back up at the front. And it's not unrealistic that a few years down the line they could get up to that sort of level. So thanks very much, Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes. Do head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen. All sorts of written stuff there about the latest machinations in Formula One. Scott's very much on top of the political situation. Some great analytical pieces from Mark as well. And of course, all our coverage of esports and all the other motorsport that's going on. So what I mean there is all the coverage of esports. Do check out our other podcasts, including the Gary Anderson F1 Show and Bring Back V10s, which tells classic F1 stories. And head to our YouTube channel. Just search for The Race on YouTube and you should find us. We've recently put up a discussion video about Daniel Ricciardo's future situation, with his hopes of moving to a big team perhaps jeopardised by the current situation in F1. Well, thanks for listening. Stay home, stay safe, and we'll be back soon.